My guest at this time is Scott Greer, deputy editor at the Daily Caller, and he's author of the brand new book, No Campus for White Men, published by WND Books. He joins me now to discuss how identity politics and microaggressions now hold far more sway on college campuses than powerful, logical arguments. So how did we get to this point, and what can be done about it? That's what we'll discuss for the next few minutes. And Scott, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You write in the book that the journey to this current political climate can ultimately be traced back to affirmative action. So as we get started here, explain how an effort to bring more diversity to colleges evolved into places now where students melt down over hearing views they disagree with and white people are considered lowest on the totem pole just because they're white.
Affirmative action was first put in place in the early 1960s by President JFK and LBJ as a way to counteract the, you know, historical discrimination and oppression that had occurred to African Americans. And, you know, the reason why is, like, you know, they needed a leg up due to the, you know, the discrimination that they felt before. I mean, there was serious institutional discrimination. So affirmative action was a way to counteract that and to give them a leg up in society. Well, what it's transformed from over the last, you know, 50 or so years is that it's gone from this idea to, you know, combat historical discrimination to a way to just increase racial diversity on a college campus. And it's not just limited to groups who have historical oppression in this country. It's now open to all minorities who are anyone who's simply not white. And what has happened now is this device has been used that students have gotten into colleges that they wouldn't have otherwise gotten in simply due to the race or ethnic background. And what that encourages these students to think is to think in a way that doesn't see themselves as American or that they're being judged on the content of their character, but they're being judged on their color and their skin color and their ethnic background. And that it encourages them to gravitate towards that identity for the rest of their 4 years. If they got this benefit into getting to college based on the racial identity, why not carry it on for the 4 years and see what happens? And a lot of these students now are advocating simply along racial lines and along their group identity rather than urging for goals that could be beneficial to all students. Most of these things are only limited to a select number of students, such as we saw last week in the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where students are now advocating for free tuition for African Americans and other minorities, which seems kind of against the American character and American values, where we're judged by, you know, as I said before, by the content of their character. And I go at a length in this, in No Campus for White Men about how this is an idea that has taken over all college campuses, no matter where it is, whether you're UC Berkeley or a state school in Tennessee. You see these types of activism where students are arguing just for racial, just for their specific racial group and not for the benefit of all students.
We're talking to Scott Greer. The book is No Campus for White Men. And Scott, you lead to an interesting point there at Madison. We'll obviously see how administrators and state officials respond to that. My guess is they're not going to grant free tuition for that many people. But it brings up an interesting point. You talk in the book, as one example, about how Stanford students in the late 1980s decided that Western Civ was oppressive and teaching that, you know, the Western civilization values that emanated through Western Europe and eventually to the United States somehow needed to go. So they came up with the chant, hey, hey, ho, ho, which is never a good start to a chant. But Western Civ has got to go. And ultimately, the administrators buckled. And we keep seeing that. College administrators, it seems, know that these students are off base because in many cases they initially resist the demands, whether it's renaming buildings, establishing safe spaces or whatnot. But ultimately, they almost always give in. Why are they so spineless?
Well, they're spineless. One, they're inherently left-wing to begin with. All these administrators and professors are already left-leaning, and they're already inclined to favor these campus agitators from the start. And second, they're spineless just because they have a very easy job. It's kind of their part of the job that they don't want to deal with the most difficulty. It's a very easy job to be a college administrator. You have a two-hour lunch break. You really just sit in meetings all day. It's not a difficult job. You know, it's not like you're in a real, you know, a corporate lawyer or something, like a very difficult job. So why they give in to these campus agitators is that they're the ones who give them the most grief. They're the only pressure group they have to deal with in their job. They don't have to deal with conservative students complaining like, why aren't we having more, you know, conservative speakers? They don't have to deal with that because conservative students typically ask politely and go through the proper methods. While campus leftists will barge in their office and start screaming and shouting for an hour, and they have to deal with that. So they just cave in. That's the pressure group that they have to most deal with, who are going to call them racist if they don't give in to their demand. And they just want to make life easier. And these campus leftists make sure that their life is very difficult if they don't follow their directions, and thus they typically give in to them.
So we hear these stories about rooms where people can go cry because Hillary Clinton lost, or getting upset because somebody in chalk wrote on a sidewalk a political message they don't agree with. I think one thing we want to establish here is, how widespread is this? Is this pervasive across most of higher education, or do we just hear about the worst case scenarios?
This is kind of pervasive at all schools. It doesn't, I mean, I previously said this, it doesn't matter. You know, we see this at UC Berkeley. We see this at state schools in red states. You know, this is kind of everywhere. There's a case of this happening at nearly every college campus, you know, with a few notable exceptions with traditionally conservative schools such as Hillsdale and Grove City College. They don't really have that, but I mean, most of the students are conservative anyway because they have that conservative character. But pretty much at any, you can look at any campus, and there's some event where there was a major microaggression that started protests. There's students agitating for separate housing for African-American students that would be cheaper and more affordable for them, and it would be exclusive only to them and, you know, exclude out white and other minority students. And you can look at any college campus, I mean, to see this. So it is very pervasive, and it's something that's only been really happening in the last 5 years. I mean, colleges have always been historically home to crazy leftism, but now the angle on all these protests is very racial in nature. And it's very almost, it's gaining in more and more anti-white in its character as well.
What's the enticement of permanently being a victim? That seems to be a big part of this, where somebody has oppressed me or oppressed people of my demographic in previous generations. And so this becomes their identity, at least for 4 years and possibly longer, depending on the intensity of their activism.
As I explained in No Campus for White Men, the reason why all these students are rushing to compete in this kind of victimhood Olympics is that on college campuses, there's a new moral culture arising. It's called victimhood culture. And in this culture, you know, people are not assigned status and value based on being very honorable or having a lot of accomplishments, or simply based on the dignity that comes from being an American citizen or a human being. It comes from who can demonstrate that they've been the most oppressed, who's been the biggest victim. And so all these students are competing with that, and to show that they have this weakness and this victimization that they felt due to their identity, whether it be racial, gender, or their sexual orientation, that's why they're a victim. And it's all based on that kind of identity politics. It's not based on socioeconomic background. You can be a white son of a coal miner and still be privileged. And privilege, by the way, is the worst thing that you can be in this moral culture. And all straight white men are evil, privileged people who have exerted dominance in the past, and that's all bad things. So you can be the son of a poor coal miner from West Virginia and be privileged simply because you're white. At the same time, you can be the daughter of a wealthy, you know, millionaire corporate executive, but if you're African American, you can be an oppressed victim. That's kind of how this moral culture works.
What about for white liberals who are down with the cause, to catch a phrase there? Are they just willingly at the bottom of the food chain, or do they have better status because they're so in touch with the oppression?
They have slightly better status, but they're still put there unless they can demonstrate that they're, you know, transgender or, you know, women, white women, if they're feminists, they're put a little bit higher status. But all of them suffer from white guilt. And that is typically a very potent tool that these activists use to gain their objectives. And that's why a lot of administrators and professors cave in, is because all of them believe that, oh, as a white person, I inherit all these bad things in the past, even though my ancestors weren't even in the United States. I'm still responsible for slavery and colonialism and all these other terrible things that have happened in the past simply because of the color of my skin. White skin on a college campus is increasingly looking like it's a sin that you carry from birth and that you cannot be rid of. You can't be really atone for it. But that they use this mindset to manipulate white liberals into giving into their demands, because they'll just say, oh, you don't want to do this? What about slavery? What about the white supremacy you benefit from? And they are shamed into giving them free tuition and all their amenities, simply because of this strong pull that white guilt has among them.
Scott, just a couple minutes left in our conversation here. So where does this all go? With this generation rising and in 20 or 30 years, obviously being in the corridors of power, and with, I would assume, subsequent generations being like them or perhaps even more intense, where does this leave America in a couple generations?
Down a very dark path. But it's very troubling because, as you allude to, and as I say in No Campus for White Men, these aren't just simply, fringe, radicals who are going to be existing on the extreme ends of society. These are very well going to be your next senators, your next judges, and your very, even maybe your next president down the road. This idea that you can just compete to be a victim, that's how we assign moral status and value in our society, could seep into the corridors of power where we base public policy on this radical identity politics, on victimhood culture, and where everyone, it'd be a terrible path for our country where we have congressmen sitting on the House floor, competing with who's bigger victim and, determining public policy on these silly notions. But that's very well what happened unless we change. And this is definitely the path that we're going to go down unless something happens to change course in higher education.
Well, let's finish there. You mentioned Hillsdale and Grove City. Those are relatively small campuses, so they're not going to be able to house too many people. So for the most part, the left has a virtual monopoly on higher education. So what's the prescription to fighting back against this from the right?
I think it's for elected officials to push back against college campuses. I said it previously in our discussion that the reason why one of the reasons why these administrators cave into these campus agitators is that they're the only pressure group that they have to deal with. What's needed is a more powerful pressure group, which can come from politicians because they control the purse strings. They can demand these administrators when they do something stupid as mandating white privilege courses for all students to come before a committee hearing and explain themselves as to why they're pushing these ridiculous and harmful ideas on students. And they only it doesn't even need to be, actual defunding. It just needs to be threats and pressure that they need to feel from elected officials to change their ways, similar to how Donald Trump, after the UC Berkeley riots, tweeted out, if they're not going to respect free speech, possibly let's defund them. You just need to threaten and pressure them in order to push back against campus agitators. And I think that could lead to a lot of good simply if that happens.
Well, as we've talked about, it built up over a long time, and it's going to take quite an effort to restore some sanity to a lot of these campuses. Scott, congratulations on the book. Best of luck with it, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Greer is deputy editor at the Daily Caller. He's author of the brand new book, No Campus for White Men. It's published by WND Books. I'm Greg Corumbus reporting for Radio America.